From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a more focused look at stories from our radio newsrooms across the nation. Today On Deadline is looking at the growing concern about children using technology and social media too early in their life. You may have heard this phrase, iPad kids. It's a term used to define a generation of young Americans who many have said are growing too comfortable with a screen in front of their face instead of fresh air. If you've been to a restaurant lately, you've probably seen them. Kids, even toddlers, with their heads buried in a game. While introducing kids to technology at a young age may have once been seen as giving them a head start, many are now wondering if it was a mistake. According to recent studies, technology and exposure to social media at a young age has been linked with poor mental health. Last August, the Yale School of Medicine reported in a study of more than 5,000 9 and 10-year-olds that time spent on digital technology directly correlated to the likelihood of developing depression and anxiety within a couple of years. What makes this even more concerning is that a 2018 study cited by the National Institutes of Health found that 95% of adolescents in the United States have at least one mobile device of their own, with 89% owning a smartphone. When it comes to social media use, researchers at the Mayo Clinic found in a study that using social media more than 3 times a day could help them predict poor mental health and well-being in teens. In response to this, several states have started to take action, including Florida, where Governor Ron DeSantis signed a law last month that prevents anyone under the age of 14 from using social media. At what age should we expose our children to smartphones and all that comes with them? To share more, Zach Rausch, an expert in the field who led research for the new book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness, joined Odyssey.
I tell you what, we see examples of it everywhere. It is so alarming and concerning. Give us your perspective as a lead researcher on this book that, you know, use the data from your research. What did you see as you looked into this topic?
The book that we wrote is called The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. And what the book lays out is trying to understand that why something seemed to radically change in the lives of young people just about a decade ago, right around 2010. And what I found doing the research is that over and over again, we saw that rates of depression, anxiety, and even things like emergency department visits for self-harm or suicide rates have all been climbing, especially for adolescents and especially for preteen girls. I mean, this was happening in the United States, but also in many countries around the world. We're talking in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and we see similar things in the Nordic countries and Western Europe. And so that is where we started. And the book lays out our explanation for what we think happened. And we can sum it up in one sentence. That's that we've been overprotecting kids in the real world, but underprotecting them online. And that underprotection really began in the early 2010s when kids' social lives moved almost entirely from the real world and onto smartphones loaded with social media apps, where now they're spending upwards of 7 to 9 hours every day on screens, 5 hours on average on social media platforms. And this has been devastating for their mental health.
There's nothing we can do when we look back on it now, because some of us have kids in that sweet spot of what you're talking about, adolescents back in 2010. So what do we do now? Moving forward, yes, we're starting to look closer at social media and what it's doing to kids more than we used to. But what is it that we can do for these kids who've been through all of that and now are experiencing these high levels of anxiety?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I think I'll say two things here. The first is this is no individual parent's fault. I wanted that to be really clear, not to feel bad, because nobody knew that these products were going to be harmful. And they also have put us all into a social trap. And so this includes those kids today who are just getting onto these platforms, and including other adolescents and young adults now today. And that trap is the fact that nobody wants to be the only one who's not on the platforms. Because all of social life exists on the platforms, you're socially disconnected, you become socially ostracized if you're not on it. And that's the trap that we're all in. And so what we need to do is we need to break ourselves out of the trap. And we also need to help parents out of the trap, because no parent wants to be the only one setting strict rules around regulating your kids being on on these platforms because everybody else is on the platforms. And so we propose four big norms that we hope that will really help change the lives of people. And that is, for those who are younger, delaying smartphones until age 14, delaying social media to 16, really pushing for phone-free schools from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade, and bringing back a lot more free play, independence, and responsibility in the real world. And so that will really help this next generation who's coming up. And for the kids who already went through puberty and went through all of this, what's amazing about Gen Z is that they are a very strong generation, and they recognize that this is a problem. And Gen Z is organizing together. There are many nonprofits starting up to push back against big tech. And I think the best thing that we can do is to help push that forward and to help create a world for them and also for future generations that don't have to go through those same kinds of experiences.
With Congress calling for bans on TikTok, saying that, among other things, the app has become too addictive to its users, many are wondering if the government should intervene across the board with all social media companies. Should we have limits on how long anyone can spend online? Should there be restrictions not only for kids, but also for adults, especially in a world where we've seen political misinformation campaigns sweep social media and garner millions of supporters? Dr. Rebecca Schlafer and her husband Peter Neal are behind a legislative effort to protect kids from social media in Minnesota.
Rebecca, why don't you go first and talk a little bit about what made you and Peter come together and write this opinion piece in support of having a legislative kind of intervention when it comes to protecting our kids?
Yeah, so thanks for that question. I think I wear many hats. So I'm a developmental child psychologist by training, and I'm also a mom. And I think for Peter and me, we were both thinking about, these are conversations we're having with our kids every single day about tech, just like you. Every day, did you plug your phone in? Is your iPad ready for school tomorrow? Did you, are you supposed to be doing that on your phone, et cetera? And I think, when the opportunity to reflect on kids' code came our way, I think for us it was really important to reflect on the different expertise that we both have in our professions and really share with the world that even though we have a lot of resources and expertise, we're still struggling with this too, right? This is really challenging for us as parents every single day. And I think that's what really prompted us to write the op-ed.
Peter, you work in tech. How do you come at this as far as trying to make sure we take care of kids, but also kind of honor the fact that, like, we need innovation to happen, we need experimentation to happen, and we also need to prepare our teenagers to go out there in the world and be digitally savvy adults?
Yeah, that's a good question. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, along with Rebecca. We grew up with the internet. And, as our kids got older, one of the things that, they always had around them that we did not is the internet and the technology that's been evolving along with it. And more importantly, over the last 10 to 15 years, the emergence of cell phones and other types of social media apps really kind of changed the landscape as far as what's available to, everyone. And technology is important. It is important to continue to innovate. And there's so many good things that come out of it. But just like with anything, we need to be thoughtful about the technology we develop and how it's going to be used. And that's one of the things that's really stood out to me is, we're still learning how best to use this technology, yet it's already available to really anybody that's able to pick up a phone. And to me, that's really important to really think about how can we best utilize and develop this technology for, everyone, but especially for children.
I feel like whenever I talk to anyone who's under 30, it is funny how concerned people are about giving information to the government, but people have no problem. They're like, well, everybody knows everything anyway. I don't care. Like, what do I have to hide?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sort of surprised, like, how cavalier people are at handing over their information to companies.
Yeah, you know, it's a super interesting point. We tried to use an example with our kids the other night at dinner, and I'm not sure how it landed, but I said to him, you know, I said to the kids at dinner, you know, can you imagine if somebody that I work with gave my address and information and all of my kids' names to you guys, and they just showed up at the door and said, oh, hey, you're Rebecca's kids. And our kids immediately said, well, they know our address. And I'm like, well, this is my point, right? Like, you're sort of snowballing who has your information. I think you have to be careful about, are you giving information to people that you want to have it? And I think the kids' code is aimed to really have this be privacy default, so at least parents and guiding their children can make decisions about, yeah, if you are willing to give away all your information, go right ahead. But also, let's do that thoughtfully, and let's not be taking advantage of kids at a time where they don't really know what they're giving away.
Then there's this. America is still working to rebound from the effects that the pandemic had on our education system. When kids had to participate in school from home, test scores plummeted or leveled off after decades of growth. But while teachers and parents are fighting to keep their kids in the classroom, younger generations seem to not care as much about attendance. In fact, some say a dangerous epidemic of absenteeism is underway. Hetty Chang is the director of a group called Attendance Works. She joined Odyssey to shed more light on how the pandemic led to chronic absenteeism in America and why kids need to be in school more than ever.
Okay, in talking with a number of people already today, and I'm sure this is not at all news to you, we do seem to have in this country at the moment a secondary epidemic to COVID, and that secondary epidemic seems to be lack of attendance, that kids in schools throughout the country, certainly also here in California, have an absentee rate that has virtually skyrocketed, which many experts are blaming on the sort of after effects of the height of the pandemic. Are you seeing this in your own work?
Yeah. So before the pandemic, we helped to create this metric, missing 10% or more of school for any reason, known as chronic absenteeism. Before the pandemic, it was about 8 million kids nationwide. It's about one out of six kids. By 21-22, which is the last time we have national data, it had nearly doubled to about almost 15 million kids and almost 30% of kids nationwide.
Is there any reason to believe that that figure has gone down?
Well, we know from state data in 22-23 that it's gone down a little bit. So when you aggregate across about the 40 or so states that have produced data and put it on their websites, it looks like it's been a couple percentage decrease. It's starting to go down a little bit. And then in some places, it's gone down a little more significantly. Here in California, it went to a high of 30% and went down to 24.9 at the end of the 22-23 school year. Don't yet know what it is for the 23-24 school year.
So in talking to people thus far, they cite all kinds of reasons. They say that, well, you know, students, of course, were traumatized, so were their parents by the pandemic, that they got out of the habit of going to school, that there's all this stress involved now with going to classrooms. What is it that your group in particular can and perhaps is doing to try to reverse this troubling trend?
Yeah, well, let me start with saying that to reverse the troubling trend, we actually have to understand why kids are missing school in the first place. Understanding those causes is key to coming up with the right kinds of interventions. And it's important to recognize that sometimes what's happening for different groups of kids may not be exactly the same. What's happening for more affluent or middle class kids may not be the same as what's happening for kids in high poverty schools that have been really heavily hurt and economically, health wise, you know, in terms of the pandemic. So we tend to think about the buckets of, you know, the reasons why kids are missing school is falling into four big buckets. One is barriers. Chronic and acute illness, lack of access to healthcare, trauma, poor transportation, food insecurity, housing insecurity. You know, those issues can be really huge challenges, and particularly in our lowest income communities, are major reasons why kids aren't showing up to school. But then there's issues of like aversion and kids, so they missed out on key learning. And this could affect kids from a broader array of backgrounds. And so then, because learning is scaffolded, they're feeling anxious coming back. There's also still issues of kids learning how to kind of connect and be around each other and deal with bullying issues and make sure that school feels like a place where they want to be. But that aversion, because if that bullying or they feel like they're failing in school, might really cause kids not to want to show up to school. And then there's disengagement issues, whether it's that kids feel bored, they don't understand the purpose of school, or there's not meaningful relationships to adults and peers in schools. And so then they don't feel like school's a place that pulls them in. And then there are the issues of misconceptions that we have.
Right. Let me ask you one last question, Hetty. And it's probably not a question that anyone really involved in education wants to hear, but it is something that comes up, and it has come up in my discussions throughout the day with others. Is it possible that this is a generation of kids that it's too late for?
I don't think it's ever too late. I think people always have the potential to learn and grow and thrive if they're in school, but that's why we have community college, that we have a lot of opportunities. But I think we do have to start helping people understand both the value of what you get in school and the value of also a regular routine. I think all of us did get a bit out of routine during the pandemic. And one of the values of routine, so we have a saying that showing up matters for real. And the R is because it's about routines. Because routines are so important for recovering from chaotic transitions and for your health and well-being. It's about engagement, because when you show up in person, you get to see your peers, get connected to adults. It's about access to resources, because school is a place where you have enrichment, you have sports, you have health, you have food, and then it's also about learning.
On the other hand, Sian Lee Bylock, a cognitive scientist and the new president of Dartmouth College, believes technology could be the answer for the mental health crisis plaguing America's young people. With technology helping foster things like engagement, creativity, and connectivity, Bylock says that beating the crisis might mean meeting kids where they are, and that's on their devices. Part of the reason we can't do this without technology is that we simply don't have enough mental health professionals, she wrote. Out of the 2.7 million young Americans experiencing severe depression, only about 28% are receiving consistent treatment. And that figure is even lower among young people of color, Bylock added. So, is this problem of technology and the disconnection and the loss of personal connections that it fosters solvable? According to Bylock, yeah, but it relies on us figuring out how to design technology that strengthens our relationships instead of weakening them. This show is produced by Joe Heady, Christy Strouser, and Myron Kaplan, and by me. I'm Lauren Barry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.